Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Kickstarter Spotlight episode, and I know that we normally release these on Wednesdays, but we're doing a special Sunday release because the campaign we're going to talk about, which is absolutely amazing, incredible, really intriguing story with gorgeous art, the campaign ends on Tuesday. So that would be December the 8th. So we wanted to give you all a chance to check it out. It's another one of those projects that's fully funded, so you know if you pledge, you're going to get the material. There's a ton of stretch goals, and we're going to talk about all of that. The project is called The Few and the Cursed, and I have one of the co-creators and the writer, Felipe Cogno, joining me. So, Felipe, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, Jace, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It was I'm honored. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things. I reached out to Felipe short notice. He was gracious enough to come on because I came across the campaign. I don't know how I missed it before. And it's just something that has me so excited that I wanted to let all you listeners know about it. So before we get into the campaign itself, we're going to let Felipe give his secret origin, as we always like to do when someone comes on the podcast for the first time. So Felipe, if you could just kind of tell us where you're from, what your background is with comics. Did you grow up reading them?
Sure.
And kind of how you took the journey to creating your own projects.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm sure you guys can tell from my accent that I'm a foreigner. I was born and raised in Brazil. That's actually my place of residency. I do come to the U.S. very often. I spend about half of the year in Florida, the other half in Brazil. I'm always flying back and forth. And my secret orange, as far as comics, my dad was always a big comic book guy. So he had me start reading comics when I was very, very young. I was like 5 or 6 years old. But I only got into superheroes, Marvel and DC, back when I was 11, 12 years old. I remember buying my first X-Men comic at the newsstand in Brazil. It was the Extinction Agenda. That's what got me hooked into Marvel and then subsequently to DC as well. So from that point forward, I never stopped reading comics. I always loved them. But I did go to film school, first in Brazil, and then I went to LA for my master's. And it was during my master's program in LA that I first tried my luck at making a comic book. And the reason was that I wrote a fantasy screenplay for my screenwriting classes. And I was interning at two production companies at the time. And I gave the screenplay to my bosses to read. And without them talking to each other, without them knowing each other, they both said the same thing. Listen, this is a $115 million script from a Brazilian writer that is at the time was like 24, 25 years old or something like that. And they were like, listen, you never get this made unless you have a built-in audience. So either, you know, adapt this into a novel or a comic book or a video game or some other media and see how it performs, then, you know, try to make the jump back into film. And because I loved comic books, it was something that was always very dear to me, I decided to try my luck in comics. So I adapted that screenplay. It was called The Lost Kids, Seeking Samarkand. And once, it took me a few years to get that off the ground because honestly, adapting a feature-length screenplay into comic book format was a lot more challenging than I anticipated. At the time, like, I was so naive that I thought, well, like, oh, I just break up in shots and get an artist to do this. And anyway, three or four years later, it was this 200 plus graphic novel done by several hands because I had artists come in and come out because it was so much to do, like so many pages. Mm-hmm. But long story short, that got me into comics and I never stopped. So I did The Lost Kids, I did 3-2-1 Fast Comics. And 3-2-1 Fast Comics was an anthology of short stories. And that's where I partnered with Fabiano Neves and we created The Redhead for a short story. And the redhead's the star of the film Cursed. So you can see how one thing leads to another, you know. And that's my secret origin.
So you went to film school. So you, there was a part of you that always wanted to be a storyteller, right? You just thought it would be in other media than comics?
Yes. Ever since I was a kid, I always liked to write my own stuff, write my own materials. The choice for the film medium came from, I think, the accessibility. Like everyone watches movies and TV, okay? Mm-hmm. And you can't say the same for, unfortunately, for books or graphic novels or other formats. So the choice to pursue filmmaking as a career was always to have the biggest audience possible for my stories. And I feel that I've gotten that same joy from comics. You know, it might not be as accessible or have like as large an audience as filmmaking, but it's still, I'm still connecting with people. And that's what it's all worth for me. It's like that connection, just like telling a good story and having people like see themselves reflecting this story or finding some connection with something they're going through or like a life lesson. Like anything that someone takes away from my stories, that's the joy for me, you know? So, yeah. So I started out pursuing filmmaking, but it was at the core of it, it was always about storytelling.
So are you still pursuing the filmmaking or the television either here in the States or in Brazil, or do you mostly focus on the comics now?
I focus, like, back in 2012, I wrote and directed a feature film called Bullet With No Name back in Brazil. That got picked up by 20th Century Fox, then Disney bought Fox, and now the movie might make it to Disney Plus. I'm not sure what their plans are. It's been 8 years and still they just hold on to the project to do whatever. I have no idea what's going to happen with that. But so for the past 5 or 6 so years, I've been 99% focused on comic books and writing stuff for comics. Like every little piece of story that I write, I always envision it as a comic book first. But about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to start looking at my own comic books as possible TV series, film work, and stuff like that. So what I did is I have a partner in LA now. We started a company together called Team Wolf Entertainment Partners. And we're making a rounds around town to see how and when and in what way we could possibly adapt some of the books that I've put out already. So it can be The Fring Curse, it can be Too Good to Be True, it can be The Lost Kids. Like, literally, we don't have anything tangible right now or anything concrete that it's worth talking about. But yeah, I would say that now my focus is starting to split, not shift.
Right.
I don't think I'll ever stop making comics, you know, because it gives me great joy. And it's something like, it's so quick to write a story, find the right artist and put it out there and connect to an audience that I don't think I want to lose that. And making a comic book first doesn't necessarily, you know, hurt the chances of that making it to the screen. On the contrary, today it actually helps. So that's why I always probably will do comic books out of my stories first and then make my way to the silver screen, you know?
Yeah, I hear that. I hear people say that all the time. Matt Hawkins over at Top Cow talks about that all the time. When you talk about, you know, movie or television to develop something and to finally see the finished product, you're moving at like this glacial slow motion speed.
Yeah.
It takes forever. A comic, you can conceive of it, write it, draw it, and within a few months, you have the project there and you're getting
absolutely
feedback
from
readers.
I have some horror stories from my time as an intern. I worked for like 4 or 5 production companies. Mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to intern at companies that were on the lot at Paramount and Warner Brothers that I actually worked as an assistant for a few months at one of those production companies. And I just have like the most horrific stories of great stories, great material, just being stuck in development hell, mm-hmm. or literally getting unplugged, like getting canceled because like the head of the studio had a heart attack.
Yeah.
So the project that was greenlit, suddenly it was canceled. It's like, oh my God, that's so disheartening. And making a comic book, you have none of that. It's you, the artist, the letterer, and especially now with Kickstarter, you don't even have to go through a publisher to say yes or no to your project. You know, you can just go out there, make it, and put it out there on Kickstarter, find yourself an audience, and boom. You're working comics and you're writing stories and you're telling stories, you know?
Yeah, it's great. I do kind of wonder about the future of the film and television industry with this pandemic going on. We had the news about Warner Brothers releasing, you know, to HBO Max. You wonder if it might become easier. They might, if a bunch of people start releasing to streaming, you may need more content if movie theaters kind of become niche. So I'm curious. So you may have you may be at the right place at the right time if a lot of these streaming companies need.
Yeah, content. God willing. It's like the world's changing in a way that it's direct to consumer now. So yeah, like I completely and fully understand Warner Brothers' decision. Like the whole movie going experience, it's going to change in a way that it's going to be like a date night, like a special event. Like you're going to get your friends, you're going to, you know, go on a date and then you're going to go catch a movie. But you don't necessarily need to go anywhere anymore to enjoy that content. So yeah, definitely. I mean, that was already a trend that was starting, you know, with mm-hmm. Netflix and Amazon Prime and then Disney Plus. But I see that sort of the pandemic sort of just speed everything up. You know, now it's like we have to adapt and we have to reach that point where the direct consumer market is going to be like the future, you know? So, but I also see that a lot of people are scrambling to find their footing amidst all this, especially theater owners, theater chains, you know, like we're going to need to survive. And you're right. Like I even see, like when I see news that DC is no longer being distributed by Diamond, that they're going to go their own way. And when I see, like you mentioned Matt Hawkins and Top Cow, they're on Kickstarter right now with Witchblade hardcover number 2.
Yeah.
So I see more and more that the publishers themselves are going to go to Kickstarter. You see like Boom with the Keanu Reeves project Berserker.
Yeah.
And I feel very fortunate. And I think I like this latest campaign that I have right now is by far the biggest I've ever done. And I think it's a direct result from people that got into Kickstarter because of Keanu, because of Boom, because of Top Cow. So all these readers that were not used to going to Kickstarter to find the stuff that they like to read, now they're in there and they're like, oh, you know what? On top of like Witchblade, they have some cool stuff around here, you know? So, and then they find my comic book, and then they find like, there's like a project by a friend of mine, Sebastian Jones, like Ruining Christmas. So they might find all these different comics that they're not going to find in their local comic book shop, you know?
Yeah, I know Sebastian too. So that's cool. A small world. Yeah. They just launched theirs. So he's been on the show before. You guys probably remember Niobe and the stuff they do.
I'm a huge fan of what Seb's doing with the world of Asunda. I think it's fantastic. And yep. I was so happy and thrilled when I got the news that HBO was developing a show based on his, because his IP is very similar to The Few and Curse in ways that we both started on Kickstarter. It's completely independent, completely, you know, like we did our own thing. So to see Seb triumph like that, just like, you know what? Like if Hollywood's looking for great content, they might be willing now to give it a chance to stuff coming out of Kickstarter, you know? Yeah. So it was pretty exciting to see the world of Asunda getting featured like that in Hollywood Reporter or Variety or stuff like that.
And I just picture Seb in a room pitching, right? Because one of my favorite things at cons when we used to have them was I would go up to their booth and I would just eavesdrop on Seb on Seb pitching. He does such a great job of pitching the world of Asunda. He's got that accent, right? And you can just see people get pulled in.
I already told Seb, like, I do the same. Like, whenever there's a convention, sometimes just go up to Stranger Comics and I hang out for, like, 20, 30 minutes. And I love watching him. Like, that's a skill. I don't have that skill. Like, the way he pitches his stuff and the way he sells his books is amazing. Like, so this is the world of Ashunda, you know, like you got lost in this world and it's this, it's da da da. And then he starts picking out the books, like, so this is that, this is that. And man, when he's done, like, people are buying the whole set.
Yeah. Yeah. You can just watch them, they're mesmerized. You should teach a class. He's amazing at it. Yeah, for sure.
He is amazing. Like, I'm not surprised that HBO went after his stuff, because like once he got his foot in the door, like, that thing is going to be like, they should have Seb presenting each episode of the HBO show.
Yeah, like Rod Serling on the Twilight Zone, have Seb come out with.
Yes, just have Seb come out, introduce what they're about to watch, and let the magic happen, you know?
That's awesome. Well, I do want to get to your Kickstarter project, but one last question kind of in general. I know right now this weekend, as we're recording this, there's the big convention going on in Brazil. I guess most of it's happening virtually because of the pandemic, but it got me thinking about what is the kind of the comic book environment like in Brazil. I mean, I know you guys have a very diverse population, you know, a bigger population than the U.S., I think, and actually in landmass, you're bigger than the U.S. as well. So are there a lot of, and I all the time am meeting and being introduced to new Brazilian creators. So it seems like you have a big wealth of creative talent down there. So what's the industry like? Do you guys have your own Brazilian comics that are real popular? Is it more the Western stuff? Is it the European stuff? Give us kind of an overview of what the comic book world is like over there.
So Comic-Con Experience is taking place right now, all virtual. I actually, like, they set up like a virtual artist alley. My stuff is in there. Obviously, in Portuguese for Brazilian fans. And we just miss being able to be at the show because it's on par to New York Comic Con in San Diego, like the sheer size of it. Hmm. And I hear as far as numbers go, I think Comic Con draws more people than those two shows. And it's easy to see how, because they are the only show that big and that professional and in Brazil. So people like wait all year from all over the country to flock to that one place for 4 or 5 days. So it's an amazing show. And honestly, I just miss, it's sad that it's not taking place in person, but what these guys pulled off with their virtual experience has been nothing short of amazing as well. Like, they've really got out of the way to provide an online experience like any other. Like, but anyway, so production of comics in Brazil, you have to look at the Brazilian comic book industry from two different perspectives. As far as creators go, it's a fantastic, really rich environment. The Artist Alley, for instance, draws in like 400 artists, all local Brazilian artists from all over the country. And the production is as diverse as the country itself. Like, there is no one genre that is predominant. So you're going to find superhero books. You're going to find horror books. There's going to be Westerns. Like, The Fiend Curse is not the only Western that we put out. We have like some amazing titles in that front as well. Sci-fi. We have like local folklore. So, and we have like, and then we have all in the middle, like our LGBT Q community is also fantastic. We have a lot of great books coming out from that neck of the woods. So it's really diverse, and it's hard to pin what would be the face of Brazilian comics. Because, and not only that, but we have a number of talented artists that work for Marvel, DC, Image, and people are putting their books out here with Boom or Dark Horse. It's just a really rich environment. And I think it stems from the early 90s when the first creators were making their way to the US market. And what I think it's amazing, it's so cool, is that these people, like, they experience the sort of the knowledge, the know, the how to make comic books from US publishers. And they most of them open schools like all over the country to teach people how to make comics, how to work in comic books. And I think that's why I think there's such a rich well of talent in Brazil, you know, like and most of the people working for Marvel in DC, they also have their own titles that are coming out in Portuguese. So And that's one perspective. The other perspective is readership. And that one is like, you would expect that a country the size of Brazil would have a bigger market. So while we do have a big enough market to sort of stimulate all that production, like, I kid you not, I think last year for Comic-Con Experience in Brazil, we had over 300 titles being released at the show. But if you take the like how many people actually read comic books and graphic novels in Brazil, that's going to be a very small percentage of how big the market size is in the US. So you do have like these two different perspectives that are kind of clashing. It's changing, like, because like one of the questions we get asked the most at Comic-Con Experience is like, oh my God, I didn't know comics like this existed in Brazil. Like, how long have you been putting this out? So like people are surprised when they go to Comic-Con Experience because of the movies, because of the panels, because of the cosplays, anime, or whatever reason they're at the show, because it's a big convention, like merging all these different worlds from pop culture. People are surprised to find such a rich productivity in Brazil. So we are forming new readers every year. But it's certainly not as big as the US readership at all. And let's face it, you guys have been reading comics for almost 100 years.
Yeah.
And I think in Brazil, it's something that started in the 60s, 70s as a very niche thing. Up until the movies, the Marvel movies, I would say, that they were still a niche market. You know, like, we did get all the superhero comic books down there in Brazil, but very few people were reading them.
Yeah, now here, we have a big readership, but even when you look at it, it's been, the problem here is the readership's been diminishing, and it all goes back, and this is the same thing worldwide. Instant gratification, instant entertainment, streaming on your phone, on your iPad, what have you. You can get access to so much entertainment so quickly that, you know, the market for entertainment, it's a lot more competitive than it used to be, and fewer people are reading. So in Brazil, is it like the United States where it's mostly specialty shops where you find comics, or do you still have newsstands there? Where people, where can they be exposed to comics?
Right. So I think exposure to comics in Brazil is a little bit more spread out than here in the US, because yes, we do have the specialty shops, but we also have newsstands. That's very cultural for us. It's a cultural thing in Brazil to have newsstands in every corner of every single town. Like, yes, they've been closing for the past 20 years or so, more and more. Back in the 90s, you couldn't go a block without going past two newsstands. It was incredible. And they all carry comic books. They all do. So, like, you would be, like, walking down the street and you stumble upon Batman and Superman. And we also, we have, like, Monica's Gang, which is a Brazilian comic book that literally, I would say, 90% of kids in Brazil start reading. That's how they get the joy of reading, or how they learn how to read. But the thing is, like I said, those newsstands, they have been closing their shop, their windows. Like it's been a changing environment. So, and like the US here, like print media is just dying. That's the fact. But the thing is, like, it's funny that the only segment that had a growth in readership was comic book in Brazil. Because I think very few people knew that Brazilian comics were a thing and they existed and they were on par to what's being produced in Europe, in the US. And Comic-Con Experience was a big boost to make that happen. And also our own crowdfunding platform as well, like our Brazilian version of Kickstarter, was also fundamental in getting more and more people to read comics. And that's the thing. It was such a small readership a few years ago that there's a lot of room for growth. So even though we're competing with TV, you know, like video games or smartphones, all that, people are still learning about those comics for the first time. So while the whole print industry in Brazil has been on the steady decline, sometimes like free falling. There has been growth in comic book readership, and a lot of the publishers in Brazil that are known for, I don't know, like their news or their cookbooks or like any other types of magazines, like fitness magazines, like they started picking up stuff to publish in Brazil as well, as far as comic books, I mean.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Well, hopefully, depending on how the pandemic goes, you guys will be able to have a Comic-Con experience in person. How long has it been going on, and where is it normally held?
The first year was 2014, so it's pretty recent. I think this was supposed to be the sixth or seventh edition. It always takes place in São Paulo, Brazil. Always the same place.
Gotcha. Well, hopefully it continues to grow and more people continue to discover comics. So, well, let's talk about the reason we're here and let our listeners know. The Few and the Cursed, as you mentioned, the campaign that's going on now. Just to kind of give everybody a little bit of background, there's been six issues previously that Felipe and his artist Fabiano Neves have done before. The current project that's going on right now actually collects those six issues, kind of the first story arc, if you will, of The Few and the Cursed. And he mentioned earlier the redhead, kind of the character, the main character of the story. So why don't you give us the elevator pitch and kind of flesh out what I've mentioned and talk a little bit about how you came up with the idea, Felipe.
So I'd say The Few and the Cursed is a supernatural Western in a post-apocalyptic world. And I always like to remind people that post-apocalyptic does not mean the future. What it means here is that an apocalyptic event happened back in 1840 that sort of dried up most of the water on Earth. So about 90% of the water on the planet was just gone overnight. And 70 years have gone by. So we're now in 1910. So a whole generation had learned to survive with as little water as possible. And that's where we find the redhead in this world. And she was born into this world. So for her, there's no alternate reality where she might want to, you know, find a cure to bring the world back to what it was. Because for her, that's the only reality that she's ever known. Like, so it's a dried up world. Water is so scarce that it's used as currency. So she gets the people pay stuff with water, flasks of water, ounces of water. And as a result of the world going tits up, a lot of curses and monsters and dark legends just started popping up. So basically, it's like people have lost their moral compass, that they have no problem in finding whatever they can to get an edge in this world. So they turn into gigantic, scary crows, which is the main bad guys from the first story arc, the Crows of Manolana. But we already explored a number of other monsters in our other titles in the same universe, like Shadow Nation or Chronicles of the Few and Cursed. And that's sort of the elevator pitch. And as far as like where the idea came from, Fabiano has always been a fan of Westerns. He loved them. He grew up with them. And when I invited him to come do a short story for the 321 Fest Comics, I asked him what he wanted to do. He said he wanted to do a Western. Even though I had studied the genre in film school, I was not the most hardcore fan at the time. So I told him, he's like, yeah, we can do a Western, but let's put a spin on it. And so I brought in the whole supernatural aspect to it. Then one thing led to another. I wanted to come up with a sort of a gimmick as to why there is a supernatural in this world. And that's how we came up with the whole the world drying up and then being like a huge desert. And then literally the pieces just started falling into place. You know, it was not something that we planned from beginning to end, meticulously planned. It just started happening. And the expansion of the universe as well, when Fabian and I started, we just wanted to tell the crow's story. Halfway through it, I met Mike at Rock Marina Games. He pitched a board game based on The Few and the Cursed. So I wanted to create more characters for him to use in the game, more stories, and that's how Chronicles was born. And then the board game reached a stretch goal in their Kickstarter, which allowed me to create a character specifically for the game. And that's where Laverne was born. And then I literally fell in love with the character. So I gave her own title. So that's Shadow Nation. And the universe just sort of organically grew from there.
Yeah, that's got to be exciting as a creator. That's the best way for it to happen, right? When you have an idea that kind of keeps getting bigger and bigger on its own and you're not forcing it.
It's fun. It's fun. And like, even though like it kind of grows little by little, it's a great opportunity for a creator to just plant something that you're not sure whether you're going to use or not in the future, but it's planted, the seeds there already, you know? So it's fun to start like, you know, just sprinkling these little, you know, nods that we can use in the future. And, you know, at some point, I'm sure everything is going to connect, but it's just been a fun ride so far.
Yeah, it's so interesting when you talk about Western here in the U.S., you know, you having gone to film school here, there's such a romantic, nostalgic feeling that Americans have for the Old West. And really, it was like a two-year period when you look at when the Wild West, it really, you know, the way it is portrayed in movies and television shows, that's romanticized and it's not really how it was. And they make it seem like it lasted forever. I mean, the Western dominated, you know, U.S. cinema for decades. And there's even a school of thought that says these superhero movies that are dominating now are just the modern Western. So it's so interesting to me that the Western has endured so much. But just like you, I was never a big fan of the Western. But what always hooked me was when you added those supernatural elements. Then all of a sudden, those became my favorite type of stories. So things like Kingsway West from Greg Pak, or another really good example is the Dark Tower series by Stephen King, where you've got, you know, that figure, that character of the classic gunslinger, but you add in monsters and magic, and all of a sudden it becomes so much more compelling. So when you talk about adding in those elements to The Few and the Curse, did you realize that you and Fabiana were catching lightning in a bottle? Did you know once you decided to add that aspect in that, okay, now we got something? Or was it after readers started seeing it and responding? Like, at what point did you realize, hey, we hit on something special?
It was after, definitely after. Like, we didn't know. Like I said, because we set out to tell a very short story, like a 3-page story with a twist, and spoiler alert, that's not a spoiler alert, but the twist in that story was that it was not a regular Western. It was a supernatural Western. So that was a twist. And we had no idea. We just wanted to tell a cool story. I wanted to come up with a different kind of protagonist for our little Western. So that's why I came up with a lady gunslinger. And like, I didn't want her to feel similar to Sharon Stone's character in The Quick and the Dead. So that's why we made her a redhead. So it sort of all started happening. And then it was much later that when we started kickstarting the books that then realized, oh, we were onto something here. Now people really embraced what we were feeding them, basically. And it's funny you mentioned the Dark Tower, because up until issue number 4 or 5 of The Few and Curse, I had never read The Dark Tower, but a lot of people came up to me at conventions like, oh, is it just like The Dark Tower? I was like, I don't know, might be, I'll look into it. So then I picked up the Marvel books, the graphic novels, because I'm a huge fan of Jay Lee's art, and I'm a fan of Peter David, and I read all of them. And yeah, it has similar elements, but man, it's such a different story. It has nothing to do with The Few and Curse. It's literally just the visual aspect of, you know, mixing Western with something else that people don't really know about. So we just set out, like, I'm always setting out to do things that are different from what you see every day. So when I said, I might not have been a big fan of Westerns, but I studied them, like, I knew the rules, so I kind of knew how to bend them to make something different. And in all honesty, having been working on on the Western for so long with Fabiano, like I kind of got into it. And I can say today it's one of my favorite genres. And to those people that say that superhero might follow suit, I completely disagree. They cannot be more wrong, because while Western was a genre and you had specific rules for it, like rom-coms, rom-com is a genre. You have to follow certain rules. Mm-hmm. Superheroes are not a genre. You know, just because we have superpowered people does not make that a genre. And I love how Marvel navigated those waters. You know, like they did a heist movie, they did a political thriller movie, they did a full blast superhero movie. So they did all these different genres within their own little world, you know. So yeah, I think superhero movies are here to stay, because they have like every, you can think of all these different rules and still have superpowered people in them. What I think it's gonna grow old, and it's already grown old in a way, is like superpowered people being chased by the government. Like, that's something bothers me already. Like, whenever I see that concept, no matter how well executed it is, you're already starting me as like, you're starting, you're getting me already with like minus 2 points in your board, you know, because that's been done before a number of times. But like I said, Marvel has been navigating those waters pretty well. And I think they're setting out to prove those people wrong, you know?
Yeah, I agree. It's like you talk about a regular movie. It's a people movie or a person movie. It's a superhero movie. That's the character, right? That's not the story. The story is where the genre part comes in, not the kind of character. So yeah, I agree with you 100%. The other thing that I think is really interesting, getting back to the few and the cursed, is talking, you mentioned about how it's not set in the future, right? It's post-apocalyptic because something terrible happened, this apocalyptic disaster happened, and now we're 70 years past that. But the world hasn't really developed in like it did here in the U.S. Let's take, for example, you know, when you talk about 70 years, you know, past the Old West, you know, you're talking from the 1880s to the, what, to the 1950s, and you're talking about television and radio and cars and, you know, planes and jets and all that kind of stuff. Your world has not advanced like that. And it makes perfect sense, because why would it, when you have this terrible disaster where instead of people focusing on science and technology and industrialization, they're just trying to survive. And so you've really created this world where beyond the redhead, the main character, you could go anywhere in the world and tell stories, right? So you must have ideas of other stories that you want to tell other characters in other parts of the world. Is that true?
Yeah. So you just touched on, you pretty much described what Chronicles of the Fiend Cursed is. So Chronicles is a book of short stories, and I made a point of telling stories from all over the world. So you have a story that takes place in the Turks and Caicos region. You have a story that takes place in the Australian outback. You have a couple of stories that they start in Persia and goes into Mongolia territory. So all these places, I wanted to show that it's not just an American-based phenomenon. No, it's the whole world has been left without water. And yes, the lack of water sort of halted any progress that mankind would have made by then. And not to mention the water, but also the monsters, all the things that started popping up. So one of the characters that I'm very fond of that I created for Chronicles, it's this pirate that his lifelong dream was to find the Fountain of Youth. And he did find it. And he was immortal. And then 150 years later, the world dried up. So he cannot be a pirate anymore. And so what kind of effect that has on him? So that's something we explored in the very first story of Chronicles of the Fiend Cursed. So yes, you're absolutely right that we can go anywhere. And we started sort of going everywhere with this, you know? So Fabiano and I, like Fabiano is more creatively involved with the stories that are centered around the redhead. But for instance, Shadow Nation, it's completely separate from the Crows of Manalan and the Redhead. So the idea here is to at least once every year we do a book that takes place in the same universe, but it's something completely different. It introduces new characters. Some of the characters are going to be popping up, you know, in one book or another. Obviously, characters all live in the same universe, so they can run into each other. But yes, the idea here is to continue exploring not just that part of the US, for instance, but also all over the world. And to be fair, while the Redhead starts in San Andreas, which is in the San Francisco neighborhood, if you will, and goes all the way to Hawaii for the Crows of Manalan storyline, the Shadow Nation storyline starts in Washington, D.C. and goes all the way into the Federation of Texas territory. So it's they couldn't be more different. Like, as far as places go, they're so different from each other. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to just sort of weaving this rich tapestry of different stories about this dried up world in the early 1910s, early 19s that never progressed.
Yeah, and we look forward to having many more stories set in the world as well. You mentioned Fabiano helping develop story. Obviously, his art, if you go to the Kickstarter page, and I'll put a link in the show notes, everybody, you can go and check out the campaign. Seeing his, I mean, his art is just gorgeous. The line work, the texture, really, really beautiful. But does he break plot with you? Does he break, I mean, you must give him the script. He probably doesn't write the script, but like, what is that collaboration like in how he contributes to the story? Is it a back and forth, or you guys develop it together simultaneously?
Usually what I do is I'll come up with an outline. I send it his way. If he has any notes to give, I'll take them into consideration and I'll change whatever needs changing. But mostly what we do is, and it works for us, is that I get the creative spark. I come up with like sort of the first draft. And I don't add any visual details. Like, literally, I just write, oh, the Redhead goes to this town. That's it. Like, and then Fabiano just runs with it. Like, he's the concept designer as far as everything visual in this project. And it's a joy because we trust each other to, in that way, that it's a true partnership. While I come up with the broad strokes of as far as story structure goes, he's the one that comes up with the visuals for the characters and the world and the cities and the monsters. Like, I might come up with a creature, but I just say, so this creature is like the crows. I was like, hey, it's gigantic crows. Like, he's the one that ran with it, came up with it, did his own research. He was the one, like, even the Redhead, I was like, oh, so it's a Redhead gunslinger. That's as far as description as I gave him. And he was the one that came up with all those visual cues. So the arrowhead in the head, all the little things that are on her belt, the dual belt, the guns, the jacket, like, that's all Fabiano. So it's a true partnership in that sense. And the same goes for when we're doing the actual comic book. I write a script. I give it to him. He does all the layouts, sends it back. I give him notes, and then he goes off to do his thing. And it's a true collaboration between us.
Yeah. Now, he was doing the colors at first, but then you brought on a color artist as well, right? Can you talk a little bit about
Fabiano? Fabiano is an amazing colorist. And he, like, every time there is like a single illustration, like a cover or like a pinup or something, he does the colors himself. But for the purpose of like really speeding through and also helping us develop the world as well, we always had a colorist. So we had this guy called Dine Ribeiro. He did the first issues. He sort of laid the groundwork and the general concept idea for this world. And then he did issue number one and half of issue number two. And then issue number three, we had Thiago come in and just took over the series. Dine actually moved on to work on DC books. So he was just too busy with Batman, Superman, those two little minor characters. But yeah, like, we're very grateful to Dine because he was really the one that under Fabiano's art direction really helped, develop this world and the look for it and the textures, but it's great having Fabiano being a colorist as well, because he's always working with Thiago As far as like giving him specific notes on lighting or texture or the use of blacks, it's just, it's magic to see those two having a conversation. You know, I just like, yeah, whatever he said, you know, or whatever Thiago said, I just watched them do their thing.
Well, that's interesting to me because, so I don't know if you know Kyle Higgins. He went to film school. He's a friend of the podcast, writes comics. He has one, Radiant Black coming out in February. He's worked on things like Nightwing, Winter Soldier. Yeah.
Kyle went to the same film school that I did, Chapman.
Okay. Have you ever met him?
I met him not at school. I met him at conventions, but we had that thing in common. I think he was a year or maybe 2 years. I think 2 years ahead of me. So when I, because the film program at Chapman is 3 years. So I think I was on my first year when he was doing his thesis film on his last year, which ended up being the basis for Cal. For the
Cal, yeah, the league, yeah.
Yeah, and we actually met through his artist, Rod Reis.
Okay, yeah, I know.
Rod's Brazilian, and I met Rod before. We became colleagues, good friends. We did stuff together already. And then it was, I think, in Chicago at the C2E2 convention. C2E2,
yeah. Yeah, that's
yeah. The Rod introduced me to Kyle, and then we were like, "Oh, you went to Chapman," and Kyle was like, "Yeah, so did you." So we had that in common. Yeah,
that's cool. Because I always think, and I've had this conversation with Kyle before. I always think of colors as in a comic as sort of the score. You know, the musical score that helps set the mood. Kyle's always like, "No, no, no. It's more like it's more like the cinematographer setting the mood." So it's interesting to hear me. To hear you say that Thiago and Fabiano are talking about the colors, and you're kind of like, okay, yeah, I kind of get what you're saying. I mean, you went to film school yourself, so you're used to working telling stories in that medium. Do you see colors in a comic as that's more the center photographer? Do you see it more as a score of music to help set the mood?
Honestly, I've never heard the comparison being made between colors and comics with score. I do like it. I think that's pretty interesting, you know. As far as, yeah, the most logic thing to look at colors in comics is through the lens of a cinematographer, for sure. I was never into cinematography. Like, yes, of course, I had classes both in Screen Brazil and at Chapman. I know the difference between the lenses. I know like how to light a scene, not professionally or beautifully, but I know you need like a key lighting, like a backlight. I know like the sort of the basis of the technical stuff. But honestly, like as far as like wearing the editor hat in the Film Curse books, because I do that, I just make sure that whether it takes place in the day or at night, or if there is like dust or if there is wind or something like that, like I always approach these things from a narrative standpoint more so than like an actual color, like, oh, I'd like this to be more red. But for instance, if it says in the script that you need blood splatter across a wall, and Thiago paints that wall in a burgundy color or like a dark wood color, I asked him to change it because, like, you know, you can't see blood against a darker background. So I just say, hey, so we need to actually see the blood here. Or I don't know if we're doing like ghost effects and if the ghosts shine too much. But I always approach this from a narrative standpoint. And, and Fabiano is a much more technical, artistic, you know, collaborator in that sense. He's the one that he writes Thiago like, hey Thiago, can you just soften the brightness on this, or can you add some texture here or the blacks here, like that sort of thing. So he gets a lot more technical. I'm the like, oh, you know, this scene needs to take place at night because of this reason, because of that reason, you know.
Yeah, so it just goes back to the collaborative nature of comics, and you're just each creator is working toward their strengths, and you trust Fabiano to it makes total sense. I was just curious about because of the film. I guess I never thought about it. I always thought, well, if you're a filmmaker, went to film school, then you're very much visual storytelling. But I don't know why I thought that, because that's not the way it necessarily is for other creative mediums. Everybody has their strength, you know, as a comic.
Yeah, but at the same, at the same time, as a filmmaker, when I directed my feature, like, I completely trusted my cinematographer.
Right, exactly.
To do what he felt was best for the scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I would go over the shots with him, and I would, like, collaborate more on where to place the camera and how to shoot the action. But as far as lighting goes, I would trust him completely to do his thing, to do his magic. You know, he's a lot more knowledgeable than I am. He lives for that thing. He's passionate about it. Like, I'm all for collaboration. I think we all bring something to the table, and it's just dumb not to use what people have to offer, you know?
Like, yeah, exactly.
Like, I've seen a lot of comic book writers doing thumbs for their artists and breaking the shots. And I feel like you're just stifling the collaboration aspect to it. You know, you're just stifling the creativity that the artist can bring to the table. So, like, yeah, like, very rarely will I tell Fabiano that I need a close-up or a wide shot. Like, I sort of write my screenplay in a way that I'm guiding his eyes through the script. So, obviously, if I say that, I don't know, like, two characters meet each other against the sunset, like, I doubt Fabiano is going to read that sentence and do a close-up. No, he's going to do, like, two characters silhouetted against the sun. You know what I'm saying? Like, so, and I think that comes from writing screenplays, because that's how I learned how to write it. Like, screenplays, it's a golden rule to never use camera directions when you're writing screenplay, because in film, that's the director's job coupled with the cinematographer. That's not up for the screenwriter. So you cannot do, like, oh, camera pans here, or camera closes in. Like, you cannot do that in the script stage. That's not your job. Right. So I learned to write it like that. Like, yes, you can guide someone's eyes through the scene by conveying emotions, by conveying, like, set pieces and what the scene's all about, but camera choices, angle shots, like, those things are up to someone else, you know.
Well, the other part of this too is you and Fabiano have been working on this series together for quite a long time, so you've gotten to know, you know, what his tendencies are. He's gotten to understand, and you're both pulling in the same direction with the story that you're trying to tell.
Yeah, like, we've been working together for 5 years now. So that's been a long time. I think we got to a place where we know what to expect from each other, I guess. Right. So there's rarely surprises there in a way that, like, oh, dude, no. You know, like, I honestly cannot remember a situation where any of us ever said no to each other to one of our ideas, because, like, we're completely in sync in that way, you know. It's a partnership that really works, you know. 5 years together, and we have no plans on ending that partnership anytime soon. Like, I honestly think that my marriage has a better chance of ending than a partnership with Fabiano.
That's funny. Well, you know, we did mention that this is actually a collection, the campaign that's going on now. You can get a soft cover, you can get a hard cover, and it collects the six individual issues that you've done. So I'm curious, was it easier to do this campaign because it was material that was already produced and you just had to kind of gather it up? Or was it more of a challenge because there were so many other extras and that sort of thing?
I think the challenge came from drawing in the people that already read the six books before, the six comic books. We needed to make sure that we were offering great new content for their bucks without feeling cheap, you know. So we never wanted to feel like this is a cheap project, you know. Like, and yes, we are catering to new readers because it's easier for people to just buy the trade paperback to read the whole thing. But we wanted to honor, like, the people that got us this far, you know, the people that backed issues 1 through 6 on Kickstarter. And that's why, so the challenge there was to sort of come up with stretch goals that would cater to these returning backers, to the fans that got us this far in the first place. So we really went out of our way to load up on collectible cards and like new art, like the extras in the book or the coin. And now we've come up with like, if we reach $150,000, $180,000, and $190,000, we're going to have brand new stories added to the book. So we're really looking to take care of those fans, you know, the people that have been with us for this ride. I think the challenge was more there. And as far as making things easier, having all the books done, I don't think that's going to be the case at all, because at the end of the day, we are putting together a brand new project. Mm-hmm. So, and we're still going to have to work with the printer to get the all the details just right. All the even the colors, you know, not just like, oh, the hardcover with this UV spotting or the gloss or the embossed logo or the dust jacket. So I think this is actually going to be probably more difficult than a single issue. Because while the single issue, we had to produce all those new pages. Once they were done, the sort of graphic project, the InDesign project we sent to printers, it's a relatively simple one.
Right.
You know, but this, like versus the hardcover edition, it's coming with all the bells and whistles. Like we have a dual-sided dust jacket. We have embossed logo. We have UV spotting. We have foil spotting. We have all these moving pieces as far as graphic design that it's going to make it a real challenge to get it just right. Like we have like red foil edge. So like the page is going to have like, you know, that beautiful red shine to them. So I think all those things are going to add up to be a real challenge.
Yeah. And obviously you're doing something right here. You know, you've run 6 successful campaigns for the individual issues. And now, you know, like you said, yes, this caters to the new reader that wants to get everything in one package, but you funded in a matter of hours and you've raised well over 10 times the amount of your initial goal. So, I mean, those are great milestones and any, you know, person, any Kickstarter creator would love to have this level of success. So I think that must be partly attributed to what a great community for the Few and the Curse that you've developed through your previous campaigns. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely. I always credit backers with the success of the Few and Curse because it's a snowball effect. Like it's easy for anyone to open up Kickstarter right now and see that, what's this that's over $140,000 already and 2,200 backers. But truth be told, that didn't happen overnight. That's the result of people coming back every Kickstarter we did. And I'm very grateful for them. I'm very grateful for their support and their understanding. And we had some hardships together. Like the Kickstarter to fund issue number 6 took place last summer, so in July 2019. And we were supposed to have fulfilled that in December of that same year. So we got delayed by a couple of months, which is pretty normal or pretty regular in Kickstarter projects because like we want to do our best. Like the way we feel is like our only responsibility is to the backers. Mm-hmm. So if we delay it, the project a little bit to offer a better experience for them, and we put that out to them and they are all, you know, up for it, it just gives you that energy boost. Like, no, let's give our best, even if it takes a little longer. But then what happened was we were supposed to fulfill that Kickstarter in March. And then the pandemic hit. And then I couldn't make it from Brazil to the US because of travel bans. Mm-hmm. And then one thing led to another. So long story short, like I ended up fulfilling the campaign in the past 2 months, October, November. And like those backers, they were so understanding. They were so supportive. All this time, I did not get one single negative comment on my wall against... Wow. What we were doing or what we were up against. And that gives us confidence and trust that we're doing something right and we're catering to a tight community. And that's what's so beautiful about the Few and Curse is that now it has a community around it. So every time we launch a Few and Cursed Kickstarter, we can expect to fund in 2 hours or less because people are going to show up. They're excited about it, and they feel like they shepherd the IP with us throughout the years. And I love that I'm able to convey that feeling, that I can share that with them, because yes, you guys are helping me develop this and we're doing this together. So it's pretty special. Like if you go into the comments of this latest Kickstarter, you have like 10, maybe 12 backers that are commenting every day on it, and they're supportive and they're celebrating every milestone we reach together. So it's a big party, to be honest.
Yeah. And as a comic fan, you probably know this as well. There's no better advertising for a comic than word of mouth, you know, because as comic fans, we kind of stick together. We know what's good. And when we read something that's good or we come across something that's good, we want to share it. We get excited to share it. Hey, check this out. This artwork's amazing. This story's really cool. And you've done that virtually here on with your campaign with The Few and the Cursed.
Absolutely. And I'm grateful that like, it's not easy. That's what I always tell people, that if you want to get to these numbers that I just got, it's a process. And it's a process that you need to honor everyone's pledges, everyone's support, and you need to get out of your way to provide the best experience possible. You sort of have to nurture that relationship from campaign to campaign. And then if people see that you're making a real effort, like for instance, you know, don't leave a comment unanswered. Just respond, just reply, just be present. Just make sure that everyone feels heard, you know, like I see so many Kickstarters that people are very active while the campaign's on. And once it's done, they write a new update every 6 months or so. And then they delay the production and they just don't give up. They don't care about responding to the comments left on the wall. Like I make a point of responding to everyone, you know, and I think that's important. And then that's the real secret, you know, it's a process. It takes time and it takes real effort for you to nurture and honor the relationships that you're forming with your fans.
Yeah, I agree, because if the fans are invested, I mean, all they want is, you know, I mean, when I was growing up as a comic fan, I would have loved to have some back and forth with the creators of the books that I was enjoying. And that's what this community that you've fostered is providing. So even if they're waiting, you know, there's some unforeseen delay with printing or pandemic or what have you, they're still getting value for being a member of that community, because there's that back and forth, even if the book hasn't come out yet.
I tell everyone, look, because of COVID, I ended up having 4 Kickstarters unfulfilled, just pile up on each other. And I was responding to every comment, to every email, to every direct message. I was updating all 4 projects on a monthly basis. Every month they would hear from me. And what I got back with that behavior was like unquestionable support. And in a way that when we launched this latest Kickstarter, people were excited about it, even if they still have to receive their books. Like, luckily now I was able to make it back into the United States, and out of the 4 Kickstarters, I fulfilled 3 of them already. Like, I literally worked 2 months and some change straight, no day offs, to send over 2,000 packages out in the mail for all across the 3 out of 4 campaigns. And look, problems happen, you know, like for instance, the 4th campaign, I couldn't fulfill on this period here because we missed the boat in China by a couple of days. And the pandemic affected those transit lines. So there are not as many ships on the seas. Long story short, like, so I had to, listen, guys, I'm so sorry. We're going to have to delay this again. I'm not going to be able to fulfill this by December. And guess what? People are like, dude, we see what you're doing. We see how much you care about us and this community and your work. So we got you. You have nothing to worry about. And most of these people are backers in the new Kickstarter. You know, so like, I don't think we can afford to undervalue every single voice and every single pledge that comes in, you know, like even if people are criticizing, I always try to lend an ear. It's like, okay, so what's the problem here? Oh, your books have arrived damaged. I'm so sorry about that. Don't worry. There's something we can do about it. You know, right. Like, obviously, yeah. Like, I'm not saying like it's all, you know, pink roses. Like I've had my share of bad behavior coming from backers throughout. Like I've done over 15 Kickstarters. So yeah, you're bound to find some bad apples among the bunch, but I would say mm-hmm. the 99.90% of backers, if you communicate well, that's the secret. They're going to be on your side, you know, like, so that's why that's my biggest advice to people trying their luck on Kickstarter. Nurture the relationship you form and the bond you form with these people, you know?
Yeah. Take advantage of what's unique about Kickstarter and the fact that you're going directly to your readers, which, you know, I've talked to, doing these Kickstarter spotlights, I've talked to a lot of creators who have been doing these campaigns. And lately, it's one of the things we've been talking about is the fact that you are seeing these bigger publishers like Top Cow, like Boom, come to the platform. And I've asked everybody, hey, do you feel like they're taking the spotlight away at all or taking money away at all from some of the smaller projects? And everybody feels kind of about the same that you feel about the sentiment you expressed earlier. With the success of this, you wonder if it's now there's more eyes with, you know, Keanu Reeves doing a project there or Top Cow doing a project there. So it's one of those things where a rising tide floats all boats, so to speak, right?
That's how I see it. I see, like, when I see Top Cow or Keanu Reeves and Boom coming into Kickstarter, they're bringing more backers than they're taking away. I don't believe in taking away. Look, the pie is big enough for everyone. And mm-hmm. and like I said, I actually feel that one of the biggest reasons that this Kickstarter has done so well is that not only my community showed up, but like you have all these new people reading like Kickstarter or checking out Kickstarter comics because they're coming in from Top Cow or Boom or IDW or some other you know place. So, like, I don't believe that, like, oh, my God, no, these big publishers are coming to Kickstarter. They're going to take away our readership. No, they're bringing a whole new set of readers with them. And these people are going to look at your book now. So I think it's a win-win for everyone involved, for creators, for fans that are finding new stuff to read, and for publishers that are, you know, now experiencing the whole direct-to-consumer market. You know, they're getting in direct touch with their readers, you know? So I think it's a win-win for everyone. And I love the example you just used, which is like a rising tide is good for all ships.
Yep.
That's exactly. A perfect way to put it.
So again, Philippe, I have to congratulate you on the success of this. As I mentioned earlier, it's funded well over 10 times what your initial goal was. I don't think I've ever seen a Kickstarter hit this many stretch goals. You've hit like 39 stretch goals. Normally I would have the person go down the list of the stretch right. goals, but way too many. So again, link in the show notes, everybody, encourage you to go and check it out or just Google. I'm drawing a blank on it. The few and the curse on Google, and you'll find it and you can go and check it out. But I will ask you, what are some of your favorite stretch goals? What are the ones that have you excited that you got to add to the campaign?
Well, so let me just say that the reason that there are so many stretch goals is I'm genuinely and honestly surprised at the success of this thing. Okay, so when I first planned out the stretch goals, I planned those out. You gotta, like, the most important thing about stretch goals is how you're gonna space them out. Okay, and I planned them on the sort of the same sort of pace that I was used to from previous campaigns. So the idea was to sort of space them out that you would reach a stretch goal every 3 or 4 days. Mm-hmm. But the success of this latest campaign was so off the charts that we were hitting 2 stretch goals every day. So then I had to adjust sort of halfway through the campaign. I started spacing them out more and more. And that's the reason why we have so many of them. But my favorite one, and that's a personal thing, like I'm a big hardcore card collector, like Marvel Masterpieces, Marvel Flair. I love those things. I used to collect them back when I was a kid in the 90s, Marvel Masterpieces 94, 95. I didn't get 96, which pains me to this day because it's the best set ever. And if I want to go for a full set today, it's going to cost me like $1,000 or something.
Wow.
But when I had the chance to start doing my own cards, that's like, it was like sort of catering to my inner child. Mm. And that nostalgic feeling of doing collectible cards again. And I was so thrilled when I saw that Upper Deck was releasing a brand new Fleer Ultra X-Men back in 2018. And man, that brought me back hard into the world of card collecting. Like I've done at least a couple of sets every year. Like I've done the Ultra X-Men 2018, Fleer Ultra Spider-Man 2017, Flair 19, and I've been collecting all those cards again. So those are my favorite stretch goals to hit because slowly we've been building our own card collection. I think we're up to 70, 80 cards by now in total. I'm not saying for this, for the Kickstarter. I think this Kickstarter, every pledge is going to come with actually, every pledge is going to come with 18 cards, if I'm not mistaken. So that's a lot. And I'm just proud that through stretch goals alone, we were able to put together almost a full set of 90 cards or so. So that's a personal favorite of mine.
That's awesome. Yeah. So again, everybody, I'd really encourage you go to Kickstarter, check out the Few and Cursed because, you know, like I said, nearly 40 stretch goals. So you're getting so much value for your pledge. Not only do you get the amazing story that Felipe and Fabiano have put their heart and soul into and created, and you can become a part of the community and share, but you're also getting all these extras, all the cards, the prints, the double-sided dust jacket, which I'm really excited to check that out. I haven't seen one of those before. So I'm getting the hardcover myself. And I love the little quality things you're adding in. Like when I saw, the pages are going to have the red foil. That's great. It just makes for a better looking product, one that you're happy to have on your shelf. So thanks again, Felipe, for joining me on such short notice. Congratulations to you and Fabiano on the success of the Kickstarter. And everybody, this is going to go out just maybe an hour after I finish talking with Felipe here. I'm going to edit it right away and get it up Sunday night, same day we're talking. There's 2 days left. Don't miss out. Go to Kickstarter. Check it out. It's at the very least worth you going there and looking at the beautiful art and checking out all of these cool stretch goals. So as we're closing up here, Felipe, anything you want to say to your backers, to your community, and also let everybody know where they can find you online, social media, that sort of thing.
I honestly just wanted to thank everyone for the amazing support. I know it's a snowball effect. I know that every backer that pledges, you know, their friends, their own community gets a ping that they've backed the Finkers. So, and at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether it was a $1 pledge or a $200 pledge. Like, I'm grateful for every pledge that comes in and for every backer. So thank you so much. If you check this out and you pledge already, please know that you have my deepest gratitude. I'm very thankful for you, for your support. And I want to thank you as well for the opportunity of this interview. Like I said, it's always flattering when you get to talk about your own work and about your secret origin and everything that we discussed here. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure. No problem. And where can people find you online, Felipe?
I think I'm the only Felipe Caño on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. I use mostly Instagram and Facebook. I'm not on Twitter as much. Although every now and then I do tweet something. But yeah, you can find me under FelipeCaño, which spells Felipe Caño. Just look me up and I'm certain you're going to find it. And if you're still in doubt, but if you find two Felipe Caños, which I don't think you will, but if you do, I'm the one that posts this beautiful redhead a lot.
Fair enough. So, okay, everybody, that's going to do it for this episode. We want to thank you all for listening as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.